Welcome to the pastor's class. This is the third week in 10 weeks on the Christian faith called Christ Our Life. And this third session is on the fall, the doctrine of sin, which I'm calling the core of the problem, what's gone wrong. The story of the fall is in the third chapter of Genesis, of course. And it's important to talk about this with regard to its purpose, and that is the writer of Genesis is expressing what we would call the language of the church. It's theological language. And at least for me, I don't believe it's a blow-by-blow description of the creation. I don't believe that. I think it's a different kind of literature. And I personally don't think you have to believe that in order for it to be meaningful. You may think differently, and that's fine. You know, it's okay. A lot of Christians think it's a scientific description of seven-day creation. So take your pick. We separate out the first three chapters. The first two chapters of Genesis are pictures of what God intended the creation to be, and particularly humanity's role within it as this unique creature. And it is that uniqueness of the human being that really the story circulates around as it unfolds. You know, you've got a creation, you've got plants and animals and fish, and all, but something else is added to the mix, and that is this creature now who shares what Genesis calls the image of God. And there's different ways to talk about that, but it certainly is meant to say that this creature has a unique and really irreplaceable role in the creative story, which is another way of saying that we are important creatures. We matter in a way to God that other creatures don't matter. It isn't that they don't matter, but they don't matter in the way we do. We have a unique relationship, and it's that relationship that's at the heart of the story, and it is the breaking of that relationship that is the great tragedy of the fall. That's what we're talking about here. A relationship of love has been corrupted and distorted, and there are tragic consequences because of this. So for me, it's helpful to think about the core issue here, the core of the problem, as this breaking apart of beloveds, you might say. This tearing apart, this kind of static, you know, God, man, birds, fish, you know, everything's in its place, but more it's a love story gone bad is what it is. That's where you find the depth of it. So it's a story about each one of us as part then of the ongoing creative world which God continually creates by his word, which we talked about before, then as each generation comes and goes, as new human beings come into the world to take up the standard of stewardship and management and the enjoyment of life, and also are born into that relationship with God, the ongoing tragedy of the brokenness of the love affair between God and humanity continues to bear itself out. So that's one of the reasons when we talk about sin, we talk about it as inherited or original sin. It seems that no matter how many generations unfold, the break is always there. The blindness to God, irresponsible handling of life. It's just in us. And we don't have to be taught. In fact, we have to be untaught to be wild little maniacs, right? And we have to be guided into being reasonably civil in the way we go about doing things. So the notion of being created in the image of God, having this unique role, didn't end with Adam and Eve, as the story is unfolded. It is part of every generation's mandate, obligation. It comes inherent in the creation itself. And that's part of what the Bible means when it speaks of being born with a knowledge of the law, being born with a sense of what ought to be done, what should be done. Every person has something of that in them. No matter what part of the world they're from, what cultural background they're from, what language they speak, what traditions they're part of, there is a should and an ought and a must that is built into the fabric of human existence. And we would believe in the language of theology in the church that that is part of what it means to live under the law of God, to live under the influence of God's will that wills us to be what we were made to be. And it's our resistance and our rebellion against that will that the Bible describes that causes the great disruption of life from generation to generation. And that's one aspect of it. There's others we'll get to as well. Okay, then in Genesis 1, 2, and 3, we have the first two chapters, which are the kind of creation looks great. You just stop at the end of chapter 2. This is how God wanted it. And then in chapter 3, the whole thing falls apart. So it's a description of humanity as things actually are. The way we might talk about this is to say that since we are born creatures of destiny, we might say, that we all have a sense when we are in the midst of living as we grow and become conscious of things, that there is a future to be pursued. There's a life to be unfolded and developed and discovered. There's a destiny we each have. The problem is we want that destiny without God. We're intent on pursuing our own destiny apart from the will and the work of God. And this is really, I think, a good way to talk about the current age we're in. Ever since the Enlightenment, increasingly throughout the Western world and other parts of the world more recently, the West has decided, both in its intellectual traditions and even, strangely speaking, in some of its Christian traditions, to really to try to go it without God. We're going to pursue the future really without much reference to a God who is immediate in the world. So the deists under the founding fathers, you know, that deism movement, Jefferson was a deist and others, they liked the idea, well, okay, there's a God. There was enough Christendom around still to, you know, be able to acknowledge that, at least with some kind of a straight face. But if there is a God, and we'll say there's a God, he created, or it created all things, and then it went away. It's not involved. The universe is a big clock. It got wound up real tight, and now it just goes about its business according to natural law, and things function, you know, without any divine intervention. And our great role now is to discover all these great laws that are at work and to unfold the mysteries of science and creation, all of which is good, all of which is great, I mean, because it is, after all, part of our created intention to be caretakers and stewards of creation. Part of that involves understanding it, you know, having some grasp of what it is and how it works and how it interrelates. And you know, today we talk about understanding ecosystems and ecosystems that interact with other ecosystems, and all that's just part of good stewardship. It's not anything the church should be upset about. It's just part of being managers. The problem is it's management without reference to the owner. And this is the fundamental breach, you see. So it's not a question, finally, though, of, well, we've got to get the right relationship back in order. You know, people need to get things in line and pay attention and mind your business. That's a way the law might talk about it. But what's really at stake here is that the life of the beloveds, to use the Genesis story, the life of Adam and Eve and their God, their father, has been fractured. And the ones that are fracturing it and are running away are the humans who are pursuing their own path. So, sin, yeah. That's what we're talking about here. Did you get a sheet? Yeah. That's our topic. That's right, the fall. And actually, Gerhard Fürthe used to say that it's probably more appropriate to talk about the fall in terms of the rising. It probably isn't as much of a fall, although that language is okay, as much as it is an assertion of self over God. So you could use it both ways, and you can make a point in either direction. It's a fall from grace. It's a descent into corruption. It's also an ascent of the self beyond its place, and we'll talk about that in terms of the angels here in a bit. So, humanity is now seeking its destiny apart from God. Don't tell me what to do. I don't want any reference to God. Well, the penalty, and now in Genesis, we're going on with Genesis here for a second. The penalty for this, in terms of Genesis 3, is death. The text says, you must not eat fruit from the tree that is in the middle of the garden, and you must not touch it, or you will die. Now, again, this is the language of theology, the language of the church, that being creatures, living a creaturely existence, we function under creaturely obligations. In other words, we have a role. We are not the creator, we are the creature. Therefore, the roles have been determined and the parameters have been assigned. And that's what this text is talking about, that this human being, this creature called human, has been created, but with certain limits. And the limits themselves are really not so material at this point. You know, don't pick the fruit off the tree, or don't step over the bush, or don't cross the stream. I suppose it could have been any number of things. But the point is that God is saying, I have determined that you will not do this. And I'm going to be gracious enough to tell you that if you do it, you're going to die. Okay? I won't explain the details of why I don't want you, except that if you do, you will break the relationship even unto death. It'll fragment everything terribly. So, Paul picks up this same idea in Romans 6, in this famous text, for the wages of sin is death. Some of you were at Lois Stovall's funeral, and I talked about this, you know, that story about the doctor, remember? You know, I know how people die, but I'm not sure why they die, you see? And I said, well, according to St. Paul, you die because you're sinful. The Bible says death is a product of sin. It's the penalty. And he didn't like that too much, you see? Being a good rationalist, you know, reasonable person. So, again, this is language of the church. It's not language that the culture is going to use or even wants to use. So, we have God, which we talked about last week, and then we have humanity entering the picture, this unique creature, and then we have the character of the tempter. This is also another, if the principal character in the whole story is God, and if then the secondary characters are humanity, us, men and women, then there's another part of this that has to be dealt with, and that is the tempter. The Bible talks about the tempter in a variety of ways. We're going to look at some of those. I'm going to presume here that you're going to run home sometime this week and read through these texts, because it'll help you if you do that before too much time goes by, so you can kind of re-engage the text yourself and kind of think about some of these things. Talking about the presence of evil in the text, one thing that we want to be clear about is we're not talking about philosophical questions about evil. Genesis doesn't try to deal with those. You know, I took a philosophy class in college, several in fact, and you probably took some too, where the professor went on ad nauseum about all the problems of evil, you see. Just all the questions, all the issues, and there are many. They're all over the place. The Bible really never tries to deal with that as if it owes us an explanation. And that's a really important dynamic in the scriptural witness that I think is rooted in the very nature of the relationship with God and humanity. Part, it seems to me, of the evidence of sin among us is that we demand explanations for everything. We will be satisfied. And the God of the Bible does not explain himself, ever. He acts, and then there are consequences. He causes things to happen, and there are consequences, but he does not explain. So that's why the problem of evil has largely been left to philosophy, because any theologian worth his or her salt is not going to waste a great deal of time trying to explain evil, because it won't work, for one thing. And evil is like... Well, it's like certain things in life where, you know, I can't really describe it, but I know it when I see it. And most of us would probably know what that means when we talk like that. You know, I really can't explain it. I really couldn't give you a long treatise on it, but when it shows up, I recognize it. I sense it. There's something of that that's going on here. So philosophical questions are not addressed in the scriptures. And we have them, and you probably have them. But you're not going to get a lot of satisfaction here with those. In the story, evil simply shows up. We're rocking along in Genesis 1 and 2, you know, and things are hunky-dory. And all of a sudden, now the serpent was more subtle and cunning and craftier than any other creature. Whoop. You see, this pops into the story. Something interesting about that way of dealing with it, isn't it? You see. It's not so much that evil is an object to be studied, it's something that's on our hands. You know, it's like, I've got to deal with this. It's part of me, it's on me, it's in me. And explaining it is not going to do anything for me. It's here. That's what that story is telling us. It's here. It's in the midst of the most primary relationships. God and the world, God and humanity shows up right there. Because that's part of the story, too, is, you know, God bless all our Greenpeace friends who are trying to save, you know, amphibians over the lives of humans. But The fact, theologically, you see, that the serpent shows up in the garden, what the Hebrew theologians are saying here is that evil has infected everything. It is present in the creation, in the human relations, in the relation between God and man. The Enlightenment worldview tends to be is that creation is sort of pristine, right? We're the ones that are mucking it up. The problem is human beings. You know, in fact, I wouldn't be a bit surprised if there are folks out there who care deeply about the creation and its ecosystems that would probably vote in a heartbeat to eliminate two-thirds of the human race, if they could, like that. Just get rid of all these people so that the gnatcatchers and the toads and the woodpeckers and, you know, can live in peace and harmony with the creation. What the Genesis account is saying by the presence of the serpent in the midst of the garden, in the midst of Adam and Eve's relationship with God is, the whole thing has been contaminated. And with that, yes? Yes.
Okay. That's something that, I mean, I'm just kind of sitting here thinking, I probably thought more that evil came when Eve succumbed. What you're saying is there not that?
They succumbed. Yeah, they found themselves suddenly in this context.
But evil was already there. Yeah. When they did it or not.
And they had to do something about it. And the story shows how they dealt with it. You see, it's on our hands. That's the point. Can't get away from it. So we say things like, nature doesn't care about us, right? Nature doesn't care about us. I've told the story here before about when Eric and Jeff and I were traveling back to Colorado back in the late 80s. We took this road trip up through the Four Corners and Third World America trip, we called it. Through all the Indian reservations, you know, pathetic. We got up to the Rockies, and we were going through the mountains there, and we came across switchbacks, and the traffic was backed up down to the bottom of this hill where it turns. And we just turned the corner going up the switchback, and way up top, you could see this bus sitting up there, and the cars lined up and stopped behind it. And I got out of the car, and I walked forward a little bit, and this guy came down, and he said, oh, it's just unbelievable. What happened? Well, this boulder rolled down the hillside, opened this bus up like a can opener. There's blood everywhere. People are dead, his limbs, and it's horrific. Well, we're driving along on a perfectly beautiful morning there in Colorado. It was a beautiful day, pristine day. Blue sky, beautiful evergreens, you know, you can get the picture. One instant, you're looking out the window, enjoying the ride, the next minute, you're chopped up into ground beef laying on the highway. The day before, the park rangers, or the Forest Service, had been up on that hillside moving boulders around so they wouldn't fall down on the highway. Nature does not care. Nature is a largely neutral environment, but not to the point of being benevolent, right? Remember, I started off this morning by talking about how this is the language of theology we're using here. We're not trying to have this conversation with scientists using the language of science. We have a different vocabulary. This is the language of theology. So where science might describe the happenstances or exigencies of the natural world in one set of words, we're talking about these things that happen randomly and capriciously and chaotically as evidence of evil, the presence of evil. St. Paul said that evil is like a lion. Remember that text? Like a roaring lion, just looking for somebody to devour. It's just prowling around, looking for the weakest link, you see. So what this shouldn't do, on the one hand, is contaminate too much the language of reason or science. In other words, that doesn't mean, therefore, everything is horrible and go live in a cave and wait for the end to fall on you, you know. But it should say that as people of faith, we look at the creation as we look at ourselves in all of its relations as being fundamentally corrupted. Really, that's not a bad word to use, by the presence of evil. We can't explain it. We can't ultimately give you a nice, tight, reasonable explanation that's going to make you sleep well at night. But we can say, and we must say, it's on our hands. It is a reality. We are in it. It's in us. It's around us. It has to be dealt with. And the
are
New
we
Testament.
Complicit in it?
Hmm?
Are we complicit?
Of course we are. Sure we are. Absolutely. So, evil appears. Now, one way the scriptures do talk about this, because after all, people then had questions like we do, right? These are texts that you never read, okay, unless somebody points them out to you. This is Jude verse 6. And the angels who did not keep their positions of authority, but abandoned their proper dwelling, these he has kept in darkness, bound with everlasting chains for judgment on the great day. In other words, what he's saying is the angels, like Adam and Eve, thought too highly of themselves, and they started getting big ideas about what they were going to be. And so God slapped him in chains, threw him in jail, and when the judgment comes, he'll decide what to do with him. Well, when I read texts like this, and there aren't too many in the scriptures, I have a sense that what the New Testament writer was doing was probably responding to people nagging him about, what about evil? Well, what about, you know, well, okay, try this on for size. You know, this is sort of a Judaic way of thinking about the angels and their role. And so after all, Lucifer, right, was considered to be a fallen angel, right, who got above himself and was cast out of heaven, see? So they were trying to talk about it in those terms, but that's about as much as you'll ever get by even remotely a way of explanation about anything. It just doesn't go any further than that, you see, because you really can't. Now, later on, when we get down the road, we're going to talk about evil in the hands of God and how we talk about that. I think Dr. Jones may as well, because I know one of the sessions he's going to deal with what Luther called the Deus Abscondus, the hidden God, and how evil is taken up into God's purpose and actually used to accomplish his will. Okay, we'll finish this first page and then we'll stop. Okay, we can knock this second one off next time, along with the next session. Okay, so, 2 Peter, if God did not spare angels when they sinned, but sent them to hell, putting them in chains of darkness to be held for judgment, and he goes on to say, then what do you think he's going to do to you, if, you know, so forth and so on. So there's a little reference there, but just a slight glancing reference, no real explanation. Another word for the tempter, devil, means adversary. So the scriptures talk about this evil as adversarial. It's against us. It works against our best purposes. And it is an accuser. This is the one that got to Luther a lot. You know, he had conscience issues. So for him, the devil was really an accuser a lot of the time. You know, psst, 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 say, by the way, remember that nonsense you pulled? Nobody's forgotten about that. Maybe you think they have, but no way. It's all up there in God's head. He's thinking about it right now, Martin. All the nonsense you pulled, you're in trouble. That really got to him. So the accuser is there. The tempter is the enemy of God and man. That's what the text brings forward. The tempter also commands evil spirits. When Jesus spoke to the man who was in the tombs, you know, across the Sea of Galilee, they chain him in the tombs, and he'd break loose, and he'd run around the crazy man. He asked him what his name is. He says, my name is Legion, for he was filled with demons. He had a whole army of demons inside this one guy, according to the story, commanded by the tempter, the great one. And then cunning. The tempter is cunning. This is the text in Genesis 3. And the serpent was more crafty than any of the wild animals the Lord God had made. He said to the woman, did God really say you must not eat from any tree in the garden? The path of evil is usually insidious. Doubt is a great fragmenter. It opens up fissures, and then things can fall apart or things can enter in. Any way you look at it, the tempter is a crafty one. So, to sum up this first page, this is the expression, the downward pull, that used to be used by Pastor Osgaard at Luther Seminary many, many, many years ago. And he used to say, beware of the downward pull. That is the essential trajectory of evil. It wants to diminish, corrupt, weaken. It wants to soften. It wants to, at the same time, harden. It wants to diminish. It wants to cheapen. You can add any word you like that goes in that direction. I mentioned last time, I think it was, when I was with a bunch of young people a while back, couple years ago, I guess, up in Echo Park, the boys. And they were sitting around, some of them. I think the boys had more sense not to do this when I was around, but several of the young folks were just using all the F words and S words and D words, just flowing out of their mouths like it didn't matter. It didn't bother me, well, if there's a pastor's here, they should watch their language. That's ridiculous. Yeah, that's hypocritical. It'd be nice if they did, but what it showed me was the downward pull, because their conversation cheapened the whole gathering, just made it cheap. They weren't really even expressing themselves. You know, when you use words like that to say something, you're not saying anything, except that you're just diminishing the people around you and yourself, you see. So the downward pull is the essential trajectory of the evil one. He wants to drag everything. And isn't that the way we struggle in life? You see it everywhere, absolutely everywhere, you see. So we call this the prince of this world because he is ruling. And mightily. Okay.